From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made in America's court system, and we open with a question for you. If you were arrested and you were charged with a crime, if you were on trial, do you think you'd be treated fairly? Your answer is probably largely determined by your identity. 4 years ago this week, the push for criminal justice reform gained a rather unlikely ally in Washington. House Speaker Paul Ryan called for sentencing reform, arguing that Americans of color are treated differently than white Americans. Ryan talked often about visiting impoverished communities. He says he was inspired when he met a man who used to sell drugs who went on to become an addiction counselor. He met a man who had been a gang leader but went on to become an entrepreneur. During a speech in New York 4 years ago, Paul Ryan said, quote, "I went in expecting to see the worst of America, and I came out realizing I had just seen the best of America," end quote. But Ryan met a wall of opposition in his own party. Politico reported that fall that Republicans abandoned sentencing reform because they didn't want to appear soft on crime. And Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump went the other way. He called for more policies like stop and frisk. And 4 years later, now President Donald Trump regularly tweets in all capital letters, law and order. He uses the military to apprehend protesters in cities like Portland. He orders federal authorities to clear the streets so he can walk to a church for a photo op. So what would real criminal justice reform look like? One of our guests this hour is Amy Bach, the CEO of Measures for Justice and the author of the book Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court. We've talked about the issues featured in her book on the show, and this summer, these issues feel ever more pronounced. Bach will take part in an upcoming program that will benefit the National Women's Hall of Fame. That event will focus not just on justice reform, but the impact of the system on women. And the event is next Thursday, August 6th. Today, we bring these issues to Connections, and our guests include welcoming back to the program the CEO of Measures for Justice, Amy Bach. Amy, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Well, very good. Shani Curry Mitchell is with us, municipal attorney with the City of Rochester. Shani, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Evan.
And also with us is Sharon Stiller, a partner and director of the employment law practice at Abrams, Fensterman, Fensterman, Eisman, Formato, Ferrero, Wolf, and Carone. How did I do, Sharon?
Perfectly, Evan.
And a board member for the National Women's Hall of Fame, of course. Sharon, nice to have you back with the program.
Thank you.
By the way, Sharon, you're helping kind of lead this event next Thursday night. What are you hoping that the public is going to gain from this discussion that you will help lead, Sharon?
Well, number one, I think they'll recognize how the National Women's Hall of Fame is at the fore of exploring these most important issues. And they'll hear from people who have been deeply involved in looking at the system, documenting what happens in the system and trying to change the system. So it should be a fascinating discussion.
Thursday, August 6th, that's next Thursday, from 7 to 8:30 p.m., it's a National Women's Hall of Fame Zoom forum called Ordinary Injustice, and it's going to feature some of our guests here. You can get online. We'll post a link if you want on our podcast page. They are asking for a $20 donation, free for students, $20 donation to the Women's Hall of Fame, if you'd like to attend via Zoom. And again, people coming from around the country, participating from around the country, and with perspective that has been gleaned across the country. Amy Bach, I've got plenty I want to talk about this hour, but primarily, what are you hoping attendees next Thursday will leave with?
I hope that they'll come away with an understanding of what is going on in the field and the issues that we're grappling with on a day-to-day basis to try and make a difference in criminal justice system, because there are people out there doing good work and trying to move the system forward and, you know, create better policies that will accelerate change.
Shani Curry Mitchell, same question for you. What do you hope attendees will leave with?
I want the attendees to figure out how they can be part of the change. I think for so much part of this conversation, I think we talk at the community. and the community doesn't know how do I get involved in making sure that their voices are heard. Because when they attend, they're attending because they want to know, they want to gain information, they want to see what is going on, because many people don't really understand. So much information is coming at them, but I want them to walk away with, how can I make a difference? How can I be part of this change of injustice that we know is part of this system? So that's what I'm hoping that they'll walk away with.
All right, listeners, we're going to talk criminal justice and reform this hour. If you want to weigh in with the program, easiest way is to email us, connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. And again, the email is connections@wxxi.org. Amy, you know, when you set out to do this kind of work, remind our listeners when you really got involved and put yourself on the path to creating measures for justice.
Right. So I was actually writing a book, sitting in different courthouses across America. And I was actually in upstate New York in Albany and met a judge who gave really, really high bails for really nothing crimes, like $25,000. To a homeless man for not having a bell on his bike and for riding it on the sidewalk. And the judge even pled him guilty for him, like without him being in the room. And the judge thought he's doing a great job because he was trying to get through as many cases as he possibly could. And that was cases he was going to plead guilty anyway. Of course, that homeless man was going to plead guilty because he did have a bell on his bike. And what it did was, like, I was fascinated by that case, but then saw that there was a pattern of doing that this judge was doing to not just this person, but many, many people. And I began to think about how we need to find patterns to answer questions about how we're treating people every day. And people don't have a voice, you know, like that homeless man, unless he, you know, has the best lawyer in the world, is never going to be able to see the pattern and then express it and say, it's not just me, it's also him and him and him and her and her and her. So I founded Measures for Justice to see if we could find a way to collect data and then compare on the county level, because justice in America happens on the county level, except for police, which happens really on the precinct level. But, you know, 3,000 counties, each with its own justice system. So what we're doing, and we're based here in Rochester, is finding a way to give people who don't have a voice a way to get neutral facts that they can then show, you know, their communities and their leaders and say, this is not right, this is not enough, we've got to do better, and we want to hold you to it.
When did you start that work? How far back does this go?
2011.
So it's been essentially a decade, and here we are. I'm curious to know what maybe 2011's version of Amy Bach would have expected could have been accomplished in a decade. Compare that to where we've been this summer. Now, I certainly take the point that a lot of reform happens on a local level, and it sort of dovetails with all the focus on elections. People don't really vote in primaries or care as much in non-presidential years, but so much of the governing happens locally, and that certainly matters. But I do want to ask about an issue that, you know, has become sort of a national pressing point. And I have to admit, Amy, I'm not very good at evaluating just how far down the slope we've slipped into something truly authoritarian or abusive when it comes to legal authority, when it comes to extrajudicial power. So here we are watching what's happening in Portland. But really, go back to Minneapolis when many of the Black Lives Matter demonstrations happened after the killing of George Floyd, and President Trump was almost immediately calling for the use of the military. Senator Tom Cotton wrote a piece in the New York Times calling for the use of the military in cities where these protests were, in his words, out of control. President Trump wanted to see, he kept talking about law and order. Well, now in Portland, you have the mayor of Portland tear gassed. You have people tossed into the back of cars. You've got officers showing up, apparently federal officers, but not really identified by uniform. And every time people start to kind of express, Amy, that, well, look, this is beyond the pale, somebody stands up and says, well, yeah, but they threw the person in the back of the car, but they just talked to him for 5 minutes, and then they let him go. Or, the officers were unidentified, but they identified themselves the next day. There's like this
That's
this push-pull. And I'm curious to know how much you feel we have slipped down the slope of something truly kind of sinister, or if we are overreacting to what's happening in Portland beyond the summer.
Oh, I don't think we're overreacting. I mean, this is the point where, I mean, you know, the thing about America is that we enjoy certain things. We just take them for granted. We love the roads, right? The roads can take us anywhere. That's an American thing. We love the fact that we can protest peacefully. That's our culture. That's our value, and it's also constitutional, right? It's our right. And to me, if this isn't something that is making people rise up and say, okay, this is not us, this is not our value, I'm not sure what is. I mean, granted, it's all on a continuum, right? It's like how you treat people, you know, giving the homeless guy $25,000 bail, right? You can only do it because it's become normal, right? It's because people are so used to people being treated that way that it just becomes the norm, right? So we can't let that become the norm, because that isn't, you know, that's not us, right? And that it's not the America that we want. And the thing is, it is a slippery slope, right? Where we've seen this in this era, that if you start hurting people's civil liberties, you can just keep on eroding. They can keep on eroding. So that's why what we need to really do is, first of all, have transparency for it, so that you can address it as it happens. And second of all, not take the excuse.
Evan, I'd like to talk about what both Shawnee and Amy said with respect to transparency
Sure.
in society, because part of the problem, I think, is that we ignore what happens. We don't see it. About, I don't even know how many years ago, I handled the case challenging and trying to get cameras in the courtroom, challenging the provision in the civil rights law that said you can't do it. And that case was narrowly decided by the appellate division, so we don't have cameras in the courtroom, and people don't see what's happening in the courtrooms, which is why it's so important for people like Amy to write their books and for people like Shawnee to provide their visions of things. And it's interesting to look at. You cite some of the incidents that have happened. One of the reasons why they came to our attention so vividly is because we were able to capture what happened on cell phone video. You can't ignore it. But I think it's also important not only to have people like Amy sitting in the courtrooms, but to have the public aware of what happens in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm. Shawnee Curry Mitchell, how do you see what's going on in Portland in the summer?
I think that black and brown people have been saying that these things have been happening to them for a long time. And I think that because they're happening to the majority, that the light is shining on, is being shined upon the police activity, and it's being noticed more. But these are not new to our community. It's just now being noticed because it's happening to a majority community. And I think that unfortunately, it's happening to majority community, but this is something that black and brown communities have been dealing with, I guess, in secret. But thanks to cell phone video, thanks to body-worn camera, thanks for people having, you know, the fortitude to speak up and make complaints and complain, things are being brought to light, you know, more often than not. But it's definitely a violation of of civil rights and civil liberties, and that it is not the America that we want. And that is why we as a community have to work hard to take our community back.
Let me get a phone call on the subject before we turn in different directions here. Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Evan. I am so curious, and maybe it's been in the news and I missed it, but this gang in Portland, this anonymous gang of people who are inflicting violence on our citizens, I would like to know, one thing is, how do you challenge that? Because my idea was that if any person or persons or army-like organization were to do something like that, our military would be brought in. And I just want to say, for those who haven't heard it lately, just because the president gives an executive order doesn't make it legal. And I'm wondering, this is his order for this group of people, right, to go against the whatever they're calling them now, looters or protesters. Does it mean he has the authority, number one, to actually do that? And what is the solution to that, to bring in the military? Because they are not the military. Thank you very, very much.
Okay. Jane, thank you. Amy Bach, you want to take that one?
The question is, who has the authority to... Yeah. I mean, well, the feds have authority over the states, right? That's, and I mean, to be there, if you know, that is, I think, you know, I'm going to defer to Sharon on this because this is a legal point. I mean, Sharon, I would think you would know this more than I would.
There's a 10th Amendment as well. The 10th Amendment protects the states also. I mean, unless there's some martial law, the federal government just can't come in just because. And I think that's what the president is trying to say. However, the state is saying, no, you don't have a right to be in here. We do have protections against the federal government just walking into our state. And I think that is the conflict.
With separation of powers, it will be the court that will decide it. So my understanding is there's actually an injunctive action, meaning seeking to prevent this these people coming in and taking people off the streets, that has been brought by the Attorney General in Portland to prevent this from happening, and it's up to the courts to decide it right now.
Jane, thank you for the phone call. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'm going to turn in a different direction here as we talk about criminal justice, justice reform. Michael writes to say, my idea of criminal justice reform would be to legalize marijuana, and make violent criminals serve their full sentence and not be let out on parole. So let's hit the first part. We'll get to the second part of Michael's comment in a moment. I want to start with marijuana reform. So let's take a look at 10 years of a change of opinion among the American public and the lack of sort of a corresponding move among the people who are elected. 10 years ago, 2010, Pew Research, 52% of American adults opposed the legalization of marijuana. 10 years later, 2020, 32% oppose it. It is a massive change. Two-thirds of Americans now support the legalization of marijuana. We're not talking about medical marijuana. They just say it should be legal. And that has been just a steady move in that direction. But the Democratic Party, apparently this week, you know, this would have been convention week, or last week would have been, and there's talk about a national platform, and apparently once again, the Democratic Party, not even the Democrats, are saying they want marijuana legalization in a national platform. Amy Bach, I know you talked about the impact of local law and local leadership on the impact of justice on communities here.
Yeah.
But sort of the so-called war on drugs, sentence guidelines, the disparities in impact here. How significant does this issue continue to be?
Look, I mean, I wouldn't say I think it's something we have to look at issues that truly, truly, you know, affect Americans in the way that, you know, the anti-racist movement that's going on right now. Legalization of marijuana is important, but in a lot of cases, the law follows culture, right? We saw this with the legalization of gay people to get married, right? That the Supreme Court decided that, and then we've seen a giant cultural shift. We've seen that again. There was a Supreme Court case about marijuana, which made it very easy for the nation to follow as well and to fall into step. I think this is an issue. I think there will be in the end some sort of legalization of marijuana. But if it doesn't happen, it's already happened. It's already become, you know, it's changed. You can see it. You know, elderly people, they're having, you know, all sorts of you know, candies, and there's a shop on every street practically with CBD. So this is happening. When the Democratic Party takes it up, you know, that's already happening. But the things that we really need to focus on now are, you know, how do we eliminate enormous racial disparities? How do we get to a point where there's greater anti-racism initiatives and transparency on that, the stuff that's really dividing our country, mm-hmm. you know, and not marijuana, which is I think we're already trending in the direction where this country wants it to go.
Okay, Shani Curry Mitchell, how do you feel about that?
Well, we saw it in my race for district attorney. It was brought out, you know, how the current district attorney, there was a disparity in the treatment and the prosecution of marijuana in her office. We know that there is. We need to move away from the prosecution of marijuana crimes, and legalization needs to happen. We know that we have historically disparaged people of color as it relates to the prosecution of marijuana. Legalization needs to happen. I mean, we need to use our data from other states on how they have navigated the concerns of our community. We need to validate the concerns of our community, but we need to look to the states that have navigated those concerns, use the data, use their programs that they've had to make our community comfortable with it. But we need to move in that direction.
Sharon Stiller, you want to touch that one?
Well, I just want to point out that I think that Amy's point about laws following culture is critically important. I started my career in the DA's office many, many years ago when the drug laws were new, and they were intensely prosecuted. But I think that there's been a lot more data and a lot more knowledge about marijuana, and I think also that it's become much more of an economic issue. And therefore, it just doesn't have the, it will happen in New York.
Let me take the second half of Michael's email, and I'll start with Shani Curry Mitchell. He says, my other idea for criminal justice reform would be to make violent criminals serve their full sentences, not be let out on parole where they commit murder and rape. That's from Michael. Shani?
So we definitely recognize that violent offenses affect our communities. As you know, my sister was murdered at the hands of her domestic partner, and I truly understand. I do know that he will come up for parole. I don't feel any kind of way about that. But what I do then feel is that while these violent offenders are in custody, what is our prison system doing on the rehabilitative side? So I do believe that rehabilitation is necessary. I do not believe that everyone should be locked away forever. I do not. I don't agree with Michael on that comment. I do believe that there are people who have made mistakes that can be rehabilitated, even committing violent offenses. But I do believe it is on the part of our correction system to correct. There are those who can correct, and we do need a parole system that can evaluate on a case-by-case basis. There is no one rule that fits everyone, and that is not what our criminal justice system was founded upon. And I still believe that it is the responsibility of our correction system to correct. And I think that that is necessary. So I don't agree with Marcia.
And I just have to say, Shani, just to follow up with you there before I turn to your colleagues, this is the part, and I'm not trying to sort of be subjective or inject bias. This is the part that I just genuinely intellectually don't understand about this part of the debate. We are just not going to lock people up for the rest of their lives until they die, unless they have done something so heinous that the system decides that they are inevitably a risk to others. And that's a good thing. We should not want to lock people up forever.
We've even done it for juveniles.
To be clear, I know we lock people up for a long time.
But the fear is that they are. I mean, that's what incapacitation is, and that's what jail is. I mean, when we incapacitate, we're saying that we believe that you're going to harm again, so that's why we do it. But okay, if we believe that we need to, in some, keep you from harming others, but then the next step is then let's fix those things that have brought you here.
That's
why we have you here.
Absolutely.
I don't either. I don't get it
because I want everybody who's coming out of prison or jail, and that's most people who go to prison or jail, I want them in a better state of mind and you know, ready to be received and given an opportunity to succeed for themselves and their families the moment that they are not in prison or jail, because that's better for them. That's better for everybody. I don't understand this idea of just pure punitive. I don't get it.
Right. But violent offenders are, you know, we do fear that. We do fear that people who commit murder, armed robbery, rape can never be fixed, because it is it's a scary thing, right? And I know that, for, you know, being a victim of a violent crime, I understand that fear. However, it's not a rational fear. And I do believe that there are those that can be fixed. Now, do I believe that there are some that we should fear that may not be able to be rehabilitated? I do believe there are some that are just that are never going to be able to be, you know, be able to be in society without harming others. But that is why our parole system is necessary, and we have those checks and balances.
Yeah, I hope listeners don't hear me, Amy Box, saying that, you know, there should be no incarceration or there should be parole for everybody. I mean, like, I take the point that Shani's making very much, that there will be lines that you draw. I guess what I'm saying is, Amy, for the listeners who are saying, well, Evan, here's what you don't get. This is about deterrence. If you know you're going to have a hard sentence, then maybe you won't steal this, rob this, punch this person, whatever. I don't know that I've ever seen really good research that deterrence works just about at all with stopping crime. Am I wrong, Amy Bach?
Look, you know, it shows that there is research that shows that you know, prison is not a deterrent, you know, for people, you know, not to commit more crimes. But this is, first of all, I agree, Shani said it beautifully, and I do think on a personal level, we're all better than the worst things we've ever done, right? But on a data level, you've got to remember that we're in this COVID moment, you know, where, you know, we're releasing thousands of individuals from custody that we've never, you know, released before because of COVID. In Los Angeles, which has the largest county-level criminal justice system in the country, more than 5,000 individuals have been released under custody under an agreement with the DA's office and the Sheriff's Department and the Public Defender's Office. And California itself has a zero bail emergency rule. So we're going to have right now, like, the most, this in like 2 or 3 years, we're going to have more data on whether or not recidivism actually did happen in this massive experiment that the country's been undergoing. And the short term is that there hasn't been an enormous amount of recidivism with the decarceration and pretrial release that's going on. So tune in. This is the moment to really see if bail is necessary to ensure court appearances, if pretrial detention really protects public policy, and if you can, you know, let out people around the time that they've served their sentence and see if it's an effective response to crime.
Sharon Stiller, you want to weigh in on that?
Just to point out that a couple of things. Number one is that the criminal justice system, at least in New York, articulates that its purposes include deterrence and punishment. But we've never really decided, I think, what we're trying to do. So in preparing for the program next week, I looked at a bunch of things and realized that the discussion is trying to figure out what is justice and how much time and energy and money are we willing to devote to it. And so, again, I think when somebody says, well, let's take somebody who's violent, not necessarily look at the recidivism rates and whether people who are going to be violent are deterred by potentially long criminal sentences, let's lock them up at a cost to them and a cost to society because of the fear that Shawnee described. It's not really, I think, with all respect to your listener, it's not really looking at the issues which cause crime. It's not looking at what do we expect of a justice system, what do we expect of a prison system, and how much are we willing to think about it, to look at it, and devote money to it.
Let me just briefly read from the New York Times' Jesse McKinley today to follow on this point, and I'll ask Shawnee and Amy to weigh in on this. This is a quote from Governor Andrew Cuomo today in his daily call with reporters. He says he's very concerned about violence in New York City this summer. When asked why he thinks the violence is happening, he says he believes there's a tension with the New York Police Department and protesters. He believes that letting a lot of people out of Rikers could be a factor. Amy Bach, have we seen evidence of that? What do you say to that?
Look, I don't have the live data, and I think there's a lot of reasons why there might be crime this summer. I mean, and I think you've never seen more social unrest. You've never seen. I mean, you can't say it's causative with the people from Rikers. I think you've got to look at it with a factual eye, right? We've never had greater division in our country, never had greater distrust, I would think, of the police at this moment. You know, the police didn't behave perfectly in the protests in New York City, to the peaceful protesters. And then there's COVID on top of it, creating extra stresses. And then everybody's, you know, feeling under pressure with their elderly family members and unemployment. It's just a combustible moment. So I'm worried about August too, but I wouldn't blame it on the people getting out of Rikers. I think that I don't agree with the governor, who I'm grateful that he led us so beautifully to this moment where our COVID is doing, we're in a situation much better than anyone else in the country. I'm extremely proud of him on that front. But on this front, man, you know, don't corner it on the people from Rikers. There's a lot going on in this country that could lead to social unrest.
Shawnee Curry Mitchell?
I just really hope he has the data. Whenever our leaders make these statements, I really hope that they have the data pointed to the facts that they expound. And if he doesn't, then I say shame on him. And it is unfair to those who were released from Rikers to have the blame, the finger pointed at them. And we have to move away from that type of fear mongering, because that's what we do. We say, if the data doesn't support that statement, we have to move away from that type of fear mongering and make sure that we have the data. But again, as Amy said, people are angry. People are worried. People are scared. People are mad. And so I do really believe there are a number of factors. And again, people are angry at our law enforcement. And I'm scared about my future. I'm scared about my health. What am I going to do with my kids? What is happening with my spouse? What is going on with my job? There are a number of reasons why violence is on the rise. And we can even talk about domestic violence. We know that for sure is on the rise. So I'm not really sure how to respond to say if that's true or not.
After our only break of the hour, I want to take Sean in Rochester's call. Sean, you're on the line. Just hang there for just this short break, and I want to get your call on the other side of this. We're talking to Shawnee Curry Mitchell, a municipal attorney with the City of Rochester, Amy Bach, CEO of Measures for Justice and author of Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court, Sharon Stiller, a partner and director of the Employment Law Practice at Abrams, Fensterman, Fensterman, Eisman, Formato, Ferrera, Wolf, and Carone, and a board member for the National Women's Hall of Fame. The National Women's Hall of Fame is hosting an event next Thursday night, that's August 6th, called Ordinary Injustice. It's a forum discussion featuring some of our guests and some others from around the country, starting at 7 p.m. It's a Zoom event. They ask you for a $20 donation for the National Women's Hall of Fame, free if you're a student. And you can check out the National Women's Hall of Fame website for details. We'll also post links on our platform. Much more on the other side of our only break. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on The Next Connections. Have you filled out your census forms yet? We are doing very poorly in this region compared to most parts of the country. The impact of falling behind and not doing the census could really hurt a lot of people. We'll talk about why. In our second hour tomorrow, a conversation with parents about parents' expectations for reopening schools. Talk with you Wednesday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Sean in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Sean.
Hi, Evan, and thank you for taking my call. I was just calling because I'm an ex-felon. I did something real stupid when I was 18, and I went to jail. I did my time, and then I'm 50 years old now. And I was just wondering, how can I get over this stigma of me being an ex-felon, and what can I do to really get my civil liberties back? I haven't been in trouble. I went to a college, graduated, got married, have kids, even the family, and I'm very crossed around the community. But I still have this stigma over me, an ex-felon.
So can I ask you just a couple of things there, Sean?
Sure.
First of all, I want you to know that I certainly wish you well, and I'm heartened to hear that parts of your life are certainly on the track that you'd want them on. But when you talk about the stigma, where does it show up in your life?
When I like talk around friends, they shun me about my past, and also for like different licenses and stuff like that, liquor permit. Hunting and stuff like that.
How long did you serve?
I did 8 months.
Did 8 months
at a camp.
Okay. I was
sentenced to one and a half to four and a half, mm-hmm. but I did 8 months at a camp.
Okay. What do you say to if your friends, if you say they shun you, that's certainly rough. But what do you say to them?
I don't. I just overlook it. Mm.
Has it impacted work that you want to do in any way?
No, not really.
Okay. Well, hang on the line here. And again, I'm grateful for your call and your perspective. Thank you. Can I start with Amy Bach? We'll ask all of our guests to kind of weigh in. Go ahead, Amy.
Oh, look, first of all, I'm sorry that you're having a hard time, and you're not the first. And if your friends aren't supporting you, then maybe you need to get some new friends. Because this is what friends do, right, is that we support each other. And there are organizations out there. I don't know if you said exactly where you're based. Are you in Rochester? There are places here that can help you. And, you know, you're not alone. There's so many people out there that are in your circumstances that do have similar, you know, backgrounds, and it makes it harder to get employment. But there's so many people now that are understanding that, that I hope this is a moment where people will look into someone's eyes and see the humanity in the other person and help integrate back into society. I don't think that was a very good answer, but God bless you for sharing your truth.
Yeah. Shani Curry Mitchell.
It is unfortunate that we as a society have a hard time with giving second chances to those. We give second chances to some, but not for all. But we have a hard time as it relates to those who have criminal records. The Judicial Process Commission is one organization that, like Amy talked about, that's here in Rochester, if you're here in Rochester, that do help with reentry and trying to establish a number of rights that you can, that the law will allow for those who are convicted felons. New York is one, as liberal as we may seem, that doesn't allow for many second chances when it comes for felons, but voting is one. We know as long as you're, even if you've satisfied parole, but you can establish those rights. But check with the Judicial Process Commission. They are wonderful with helping you, may be able to get a certificate of relief from disability. You may be able to wipe out that felony conviction to some extent. It all depends. So you might want to check with the Judicial Process Commission. But when it comes to, you know, quote unquote friends who are not very supportive, I would agree with Amy. You might need to find some additional friends. But if you're not having a problem with a job, you've already ahead of the game, because most convicted felons have a problem with that. But I know the benefit of working with the city of Rochester, that is one thing that they don't shun you, or that's not an obstacle, I would say, with working with the city of Rochester. But I'm happy to hear that part. But the Judicial Process Commission can help you with some of those obstacles, legal obstacles you are having.
Okay. Anything, Sharon Stiller, you want to add?
Sure. The society has begun. First of all, it doesn't know how to treat people who've been released from prison. And I think it took tremendous courage, Sean, for you to make this call. So I think that's fabulous. But the laws are beginning to take a bit of a look at it, so they are permitting expungement or getting rid of some records in certain situations. Also, the laws protect people who've been convicted of crime from being discriminated against, so long as there's not a relationship between the crime and employment. But, you know, I think this is just like the other issues we're talking about. The more we look at the issue, the more we talk about the issue, the more we'll come up with solutions that work for both the person who's been released from prison as well as society.
Sean.
Right. I appreciate the comment. Thank you.
Hey, Sean, before you go here, how, you know, when you talk about being Sean, I just want to ask how you're doing mentally. I mean, how are you day to day?
Day to day, I'm great. It's just that every day I do think about what I did that when I was 19, even when I was 18. Like I said, I'm 50 years old now. So it's on my mind a lot. I talk about it a lot. My wife and I talk about it. But it's just, I just feel like, you know, I'm stuck in this position to where I really can't advance.
Yeah. Well, I think to Amy's point, you know, no one, you know, ought to be measured on just their worst moments, worst days, worst actions, worst things people have said. I mean, look, I'd be canceled in a minute if that's what I was based on. And I just hope that you feel some love and support, and I'm really glad you called, and good luck to you. Thank you, Sean.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Well, and, you know, I mean, there's, Shawnee, there's probably a lot of people in that position who, you know, I take Sean as sincere. He wants to be a loving husband and a father and wants to work and wants to be a friend, but feels like sort of can't escape. And I'm not saying we aren't accountable for our actions, not by any means, but I also feel like, you know, I think your point's an important one maybe to build on, Shawnee, for the audience. If Sean's working, he is, as you said, sort of ahead of where a lot of people would be in his position. Is that right, Shawnee?
That is correct, because there are so many employers who will not take a chance on someone who's a convicted felon. And therefore, that keeps them in this life of crime. So it's a cycle. So they can't move from the criminal aspect of their past because they can't then feed their family and provide. So they go back to what they know, which is a life of crime. So, you know, being, you know, employed, you know, being an employee of the city, you don't have to check the box, right? That's not an issue. And we're happy that many other employers are starting to do that, but that's not, that is still not the norm. That is still not accepted, you know, in our society. However, for some, you know, it's amazing. I love the show American Greed. So it's on CNBC, and we see white collar criminals who go to prison and come out and start over, and they're millionaires. You're like, well, how does that happen? But there's still some aspects of our society where it's okay to be a felon, but just not, it doesn't work that way for everyone.
Before the hour is up, let me ask all three of you. You know, Amy, you said earlier this hour, you want to keep your eyes on the things that really impact the most people, the most important reforms. What is the single most important reform as you see it that either hasn't been made or maybe has been stalled or people ought to be keeping their eyes on?
I think that, you know, look, all I do is think about data all day long, so my answer has that framework. But we need to get to a point where there is reliable, valid data and that people who live in the communities can have conversations where they wouldn't before. You know, the stakes are so high right now. I mean, what could be higher than what's happened to people of color in the United States over the past 250 years, right? But the debate is just too polarized. It's not data-led. So imagine if your prosecutor had data that would put out, and then they had to meet with the community on a monthly, quarterly basis and explain the numbers and why they're going to do better. And, you know, and if it doesn't work, the community can vote the prosecutor out of office. Like, that's what I'm talking about. That's what needs to happen next in order for reform to happen. It needs to happen with policing and also with the courts.
Shawnee Curry Mitchell, what reform is the most important that might be within reach?
Interesting. I think the reform that is closest to that's within reach is police. I think that we're close to. I don't know. I don't think that any reform, I think the reforms that we just passed, let me say this, the reforms that we passed here in New York State as it relates to the bail reform were good, and I think that we're working to make them better. And but we're so polarized, and we just had, you know, just passed some new legislation as it relates to, you know, suspended license and things like that. Like, New York State is on top of things here. We have a long way to go. I think we're so far apart as it relates to true police and police reform that I don't think we're going to get anywhere anytime soon. But I think that the reforms that we've made thus far, I think they're going to get better, and we're going to become comfortable with the progress that we've made with it. But as it relates to the true reform that we need as it relates to police and community relations, we're still too far apart.
About 40 seconds. Sharon Stiller, final thoughts from you.
We need to open our eyes and look at the justice system. We need to make decisions about what we expect, what we mean by justice, and then we have to make sure it's provided.
Pretty direct. If you want to join not only the panelists today, but the panel has other members who were not able to join this conversation, check out the National Women's Hall of Fame website for the information on the event, Ordinary Injustice. And it's next Thursday, August 6th, starting at 7 p.m. The Zoom forum, anyone can attend. Students, free. They're asking $20 donation to the National Women's Hall of Fame for other attendees. And you can check out the full list there. And I want to thank our guests for making the time. Sharon Stiller will be running the show next Thursday. It's nice to have you as always, Sharon. Thanks for making time for the program.
Thank you, Evan.
Shawnee Curry Mitchell is a municipal attorney with the City of Rochester. Appreciate your perspective, and thanks for making time, Shawnee.
Thank you so much, Evan.
Amy Bach, the CEO of Measures for Justice, author of Ordinary Injustice, How America Holds Court. Amy, I always appreciate your, as you said, data-driven perspective. Thanks for that, and let's talk again soon.
I appreciate you. Thank you.
All right. And we'll put a link, by the way, listeners, on our podcast page if you want to check out what the National Women's Hall of Fame is offering. Rob Braden is the engineer of Connections, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a nice afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.